You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh, yeah. Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
Good morning, listeners. It's a beautiful and wet and warm.
Tropical.
Very tropical Wednesday.
Okay, I'm shivering, I have to admit. I'm from Malaysia and I'm cold.
It's an interesting burst of weather, isn't it?
It is. It's cold, is it? Oh, I don't know.
Well, it's certainly cold here in the studio.
It is cold in the studio.
Nice to be back in the studio, though.
It is. Yes, I've been away for a couple of weeks, so doubly nice for me.
Nice to see you back.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for coming back.
Perhaps we should just say who we are.
Yes.
Who have we got in the studio today?
Yes. Oh, well, my name is Jesse.
And Marty.
And I'm Sonia.
Yes. And we've got an exciting show, as usual. We have first, of course, the news headlines. After that, we go to the second part of an interview I did with Dr. Richard Fijo, who is a Northern Territory Larrakia Omoramungu elder. And we speak about, or continue the conversation, about his decision to step down from the Darwin Waterfront Corporation, which was in protest of the Northern Territory government reducing the age of criminal responsibility from 12 years old to 10 years old.
And after that, we actually have the first part of a series with Dr. Holly High on Laos. Dr. Holly High was trained at ANU and focused her studies on Laos, conducting fieldwork. She's held postdoctoral position at Yale, so very high-profile person then.
Yes.
We will have the deputy leader of the Greens, Sarah Mansfield, coming in, well, on the phone, to talk about a Greens proposal to add abortion rights to the Constitution in Victoria, which I think is quite exciting.
Very nice. And after that?
After that, and then we have an interview with Natalie from Teachers for Palestine, who will be talking to us about scholasticide, the killing of teachers and education and cultural heritage in Palestine.
Right. Yes, and that's in relation to, I believe there's a rally on tomorrow.
Tomorrow there is a rally on a protest on this issue in preparation and run up to a day of action the day after on the 29th. So we'll be talking to Natalie about that.
Terrific. Thanks, everyone. So let's go to the news headlines right now.
Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty gritty. Let's get right down to the real nitty gritty now. One, two, nitty gritty now, yeah, boom. Nitty gritty, who?
It's 7:05, you're listening to 3CR. These are our news headlines for Wednesday, the 27th of November. The United States Senate last week voted overwhelmingly to reject an effort to block the sale of offensive weapons to Israel. Given the bipartisan support for continuing to arm Israel, even as it continues over a decade of genocide in Gaza, the effort, led by independent Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, was not expected to pass. Yet the resolution, supported by a handful of progressive senators, made a strong point of rejecting the US foreign policy status quo of unconditional support for Israel. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's extremist government has not simply waged war against Hamas, it has waged war against Palestinians, Sanders said during a press conference held a day before the Senate vote. Much of what's been happening there has been done with US weapons and American taxpayer support, Sanders said. The United States of America is complicit in these atrocities. This complicity must end. The Sanders-led attempt joins the long-standing popular demand of an arms embargo on Israel. 61% of people in the US are against continued US aid to Israel. A poll from February found most Democratic Party voters would have supported a presidential candidate who does not back US aid to Israel. In July, seven major trade unions in the United States signed on to a letter demanding an arms embargo and that the US help secure a ceasefire in Gaza. The unions represent a total of 6 million workers, which is almost half of all unionized workers in the US. Only 19 out of 100 senators, including Sanders himself, voted to oppose the sale of some offensive arms to Israel. The Senate vote came a day before the US fundamentally rejected the newly issued International Criminal Court arrest warrants against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and former Defence Minister Yoav Gallant for war crimes and crimes against humanity. More than a third of First Nations households across the country experienced food insecurity due to a lack of money for food in the last year, a new survey has revealed. The National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Health Survey, conducted by the Australian Bureau of Statistics, measured about 7,700 Indigenous people from approximately 4,900 households across the country in both remote and non-remote areas. It comes in the midst of a cost of living crisis, which has forced the federal government to invest $9.6 million in food security for First Nations people in remote communities. The level of food insecurity was higher in... The level of food insecurity was higher... I'm just having a slight issue here.
The level of food insecurity was higher in remote areas, with 50.7% of households outside of cities and regional areas experiencing food insecurity in the last 12 months, compared to 40.4% in non-remote areas. Across the country, 17% of First Nations people said they have experienced food insecurity, and now I've lost it as well. Sorry about this, folks.
Right.
We're having issues with our...
Could be the rain, Sonia.
It's probably the rain. With
I can take it from there if you like.
Okay.
There is a quote here from the National Strategy for Food Security in remote First Nations communities, in partnership with state and territory governments and First Nations health organisations, which is aimed at improving access to nutritious and affordable food and groceries, is expected to be finalised by early 2025.
Shall I take the next story?
Please do, Sonia. Thank you very much.
The National Aeronautics and Space Administration has announced the ozone hole above the South Pole was relatively small in 2024 compared to previous years. The agency has indicated that if current trends continue, the ozone layer, which acts as a planetary sunscreen protecting us from harmful ultraviolet radiation from the sun, could fully recover by 2066. In its statement, NASA noted that during the peak of the ozone depleting season, which runs from September 7th to October 13th, the size of the ozone hole in 2024 ranked as the seventh smallest since recovery efforts began in 1992. This recovery process was initiated following the Montreal Protocol, a landmark international agreement designed to phase out ozone-depleting chemicals. Scientists define the ozone hole as the region where ozone concentrations fall below the historical threshold of 220 Dobson units. This year, the hole reached its largest extent on September 28th, covering an area of 22.4 million square kilometres. The observed improvement is attributed to a combination of the continued decline in chlorofluorocarbon use and an unexpected infusion of airborne ozone from northern Antarctica. To classify holes in the ozone layer, NASA and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration have been using satellite data since 1979, and according to this record, this year's hole ranked 20th amongst the smallest in terms of area. Paul Newman, leader of NASA's ozone research team, said the gradual improvement observed demonstrates that international efforts to reduce ozone-depleting chemicals are yielding results. And on a personal note, I think it bodes well for efforts to tackle climate catastrophe as well.
Yes, at least there's some positivity in that last news item. Thanks for getting onto that one. And finally, Iran has condemned the European Union and the United Kingdom for imposing a fresh round of sanctions last week against Iran. The EU and UK sanctions target several Iranian individuals and companies. These include the Islamic Republic of Iran Shipping Lines and Iran Air. The UK froze the assets of the Islamic Republic of Iran Shipping Lines and Iran Air, claiming these entities were used to transfer ballistic missiles and other military supplies to Russia. The EU and the UK have used the pretext of Iran supplying drones and ballistic missiles to Russia to impose additional sets of sanctions on Iran, in addition to those related to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, without providing any evidence of the same. Ismail Baghai, the spokesperson for Iran's foreign ministry, denounced the claims made by the EU and the UK about his country supplying ballistic missiles to Russia, calling them unfounded. Baghai claimed that using false pretext to justify completely unjustifiable sanctions against Iran violates their commitments under the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, also known as the Iran nuclear deal. In a statement issued by its Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Iran claimed that the sanctions are contrary to international law and therefore illegitimate, and once again called for their immediate withdrawal. EU members France and Germany, in addition to the UK, are signatories of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which was also signed by Iran, the US, Russia and China in 2016. In 2019, the US withdrew from the deal unilaterally and imposed sanctions against Iran in violation of the provisions of the deal. And that's our news headlines for this Wednesday, the 27th of November. It's 7:13. You're on 3CR.
So this is in the middle of the pandemic where this billionaire is suing the Pentagon for a military contract for what most people think is the place that you order books from. It's a very interesting case study in pulling out the different threads of militarism and how it can really be embedded in so many aspects of our lives that we don't even realize that when we order something from Amazon that we're putting workers' lives at risk and that we're supporting what is becoming an increasingly important actor in the military-industrial complex. Exposing that to people, I think, is very important. People will care if they understand that this is how things are all interconnected and linked. It's surfacing that information, it's making that accessible, and making it relevant for people's lives. And I think that is another opportunity that COVID-19 really presents to us, is that we are all connected and these structures are all connected. We can see that much more clearly now than we could before.
We need to keep radical voices on air. Subscribe now.
Go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe or call the station on 9419 8377.
You're on 3CR, and just before we go to our first interview of the morning, 7:15, we'll have a song. This is Adrian Lenka with Sadness as a Gift.
coming.
This song here is it's on the album. It'll be coming out pretty soon. On the wrong side of the road. Hope you like it.
Sadness is a gift. Adrian Lenker, it's a very nice rainy morning song. Sadness is a Gift, that's from her album Bright Future, which was released only this year, actually, I think. Yeah. And it's 7:20, you're on 3CR.
Address the deep underlying issues that still pervade Australian society. And that primary issue is white Australian racism.
We've got a clear-cut case here of intentional genocide from the get-go, from the round table in England.
The true history in this country isn't told. The government always say that they're committed to a truth-telling process. Well, where is your truth-telling process?
I really believe that at the end of the day, the truth will emerge. You can't fight against the truth. It's an unstoppable force. It's indestructible. So deal with it.
3CR. Stay tuned, stay radical.
Okay, so next up we will hear from the second part of the interview we did with Dr. Richard Feger. We pick up the discussion, continuing where Dr. Feger discusses his experiences working with the Northern Territory government and his own philosophy in dealing with those injustices. And it's in relation to his decision to step down from the Darwin Waterfront Corporation in protest of the laws of lowering the criminal age of responsibility from 12 to 10.
And then there's the troublemakers, the stirrers. So we're trying to claim your backyard.
Yeah.
You know, what a joke. That's insulting. But this is to instill fear into the populations, you know. And so now the weight that we carry as traditional owners becomes the weight of the world on our shoulders. And that's the weight that we're forced to carry. Now, I've learned over time and working in medicine that we can use our minds and our hearts to actually control how the in social and emotional well-being impacts on us. I've actually suffered from depression in the past, and I've found my way out of it. I had a dream that once I was walking and I was carrying the world on my shoulders, and it was heavy. So I was struggling to take one step at a time. But then something happened and I started standing upright. And as I started standing upright, the world got smaller. So when I was actually fully upright, it was the size of a soccer ball on my shoulder. And I held my hand out, and the soccer ball rolled down my arm. By the time it got to the palm of my hand, it was the size of a marble. And I realized we can carry the weight of the world on our shoulders, or we can carry the world in the palm of our hands. And this is you know, something that I always use in my own reflective healing practice. And there's going to be times where we're challenged. These are one of those times. So we can be angry about it. We have the right to be angry about it. But one of the things I've learned is this bill being passed is an action. And so what I did was an action, because actions do speak louder than words. And the purpose of me doing that was to actually say, I've had enough, you know. To be the chairman of the board of Darwin Waterfront, and I'll be very clear, I love Darwin Waterfront. I have no issue with the staff, the management, or the board members. This is not about them. I'll always be a friend of Darwin Waterfront. You know, it's a good popular tourist destination. And we just recently won an award for tourism, a Brolger Award, which is very highly received. And even now I shared that on my social media because I'm celebrating for them and the team down there. But it comes under a government that's willing to lock up 10-year-old children. And we've seen this happen before in our previous history with mandatory sentencing, where they was locking up all the Aboriginal kids. And mandatory sentencing meant that they went straight to jail. There was no point of having defence lawyers because the discretion was taken away. And so what happened was during that period, they were locking up all the kids and all the parents were up in arms, you know. Then they locked up a white kid. And that changed the narrative because then all the white parents started jumping up in arms, the white population, because it's okay to do that to the black population, according to some people. But once it goes outside of the black population, well, they're all up in arms about it, aren't they? And, you know, I'm not going to bounce around and joke around. It's the truth. And people need to hear the truth and they need to face the truth and they need to accept the truth. So what's going to happen here? They're going to start locking up 10-year-old kids until they lock up a white 10-year-old kid. And then all hell's going to break loose. All the white people will be banging down the doors of Parliament and saying, get rid of this government, because this is just history repeating itself. I've lived long enough to see this. You know, we have this from my mother's time, from the 1930s, and these draconian laws that are way outdated. But some people would just want to see the blacks out of the way, because it means that they can walk around without a conscience. And they don't have to see us. But what they forget is this is our land, this is our country. And when they dispossessed us from it, they dispossessed us from our wealth, from our opportunities, from our growth. And even more than that, we realise, and this happens, and I'm pretty sure every First Nation person would agree with me, we're actually further disadvantaged through the school systems. Because a lot of the schools that we go to, we're getting through primary school okay, but then when we go to the high school, we represent approximately 10% of the population of each high school. So we go in there as a minority. And you know what? We're so good at sports. We're so good at arts. We're so good at so many things that sometimes we're put down. And sometimes we're put down by students, and sometimes we're put down by teachers. Sometimes we're put down by the systems. And so what happens? We drop out. And to survive, when we drop out of schools, we go and survive by going to the same group that dropped out of schools with us. And that's gangs sometimes. Sometimes it's not just gangs, it's just groups of people that are trying to survive. And so they go together. But then they get under the bad influence, you know, alcohol and drugs and all that, and they go into that cycle of criminal, you know, especially in the young age when, you know, the young mind can be influenced quite easily. And we know that. We've all lived that. Every one of us have, you know. No one lives a perfect life. Someone's broken the law at some point, even white people, you know. I mean, everyone's done that. We've lived. And the thing is, so we're disadvantaged going through the education system. When we drop out of school, we go into those things. If we get arrested, it makes it harder for us to get a job. Even if we don't get arrested, we don't have the skills of the year 10 or 12 equivalent to go into universities for higher learning. You know, sometimes people get the opportunities to go to vet and things like that. But a lot of times people just get turned away from jobs. And the discrimination of trying to rent a house and start a family for First Nations people. People look at the colour of our skin and they just say, no, sorry, this is taken. Let's tell the truth here. Let's face the facts. Racism is rampant in Australia and it's in the population and it's experienced in areas of the government. And I'm not saying all government, I'm saying sections of the government. And it particularly becomes evident when bills like this are passed, when we know to lower the age to 10 years old for people to get arrested. And NT has already got 3.4 times the amount of adults being arrested in the Northern Territory than our closest neighbour, Western Australia. We're 3.4 times that arrest rate. And I've said, stats and facts. Do your homework. Stats and facts. People will talk crap on the internet, but stats and facts don't lie. So I go to the legal services, a reliable source, the Aboriginal Legal Service. I was there yesterday, and I said, we need to start a petition. We need to let people know it's not okay to lock up 10-year-old children. Can you provide the stats and facts of how many people are being arrested, First Nations and non-First Nations? Can you provide the stats and facts around the people that are incarcerated, First Nations versus non-First Nations? We have to look at the stats and facts of people in hospitals, First Nations to non-First Nations. We have to look at the deaths in custody, First Nations. I could go on and on. Like, you could talk about the death rates, you know? I've been to a conference where I was challenged by someone and they said there's no difference between an Aboriginal person and a non-Aboriginal person medically. And this was like 10 years ago. And this person said to me, what is the difference? One difference, name one difference, there's difference between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people. And I said, our life expectancy. You know, you can't argue with that. The evidence is clear. So why do we have a discriminating government in place implementing discriminating laws that's targeting First Nations people? Because you know as well as I do, and so does every listener out there, that my black child walks into a supermarket, the security's going to follow the black child around. It even happens with me, and I'm over 50 years old, and security are watching me. They don't see an honorary doctor. They don't see a chairman. They don't see they don't see all kinds of things about me. What they see is a black man, you know? So I have that lived history where I was down south once, I won't say where, but I was down south once and I was driving in the countryside, rock flew up and cracked my windscreen. So I went and dropped it into the car place and said, can you fix my windscreen? How long will that take? And they said, an hour. And I said, okay, I'll go to the TAB, put some bets on the horses, and I'll come back in an hour. And I'm not really a gambler, but I just thought, I've got to get in the aircon. And so I went to the TAB. I waited an hour, came back, and the police were waiting for me in the mechanic shop. I walked in there, and I said to the mechanic guy, I said, have you got my keys? And he said, yeah, it's here. And I said to the police officer, here's my driver's license. Is that current? Ring your police station. And he said, is that current? And he checked my driver's license, and it was current. I said, there's my rego number. Is my car current? And he looked and he said, yeah, it's registered. And I said, well, tell this idiot to give me my car keys because I'll never do business with him again. And back then, I reported him to the Anti-Discrimination Commission. The police were actually really good then because I provided the facts, you know, and the facts was I was licensed and so my car was registered. But this happens to us daily. And we see it daily. It doesn't matter how subtle it is, from the looks we get when we walk into a hotel, you know, to a supermarket, when the looks that we get when we walk into a shop, you know, and the security guards look at us, you know, we know that is factual because we live it. Every First Nation person lives it. And for every other non-First Nations people that don't live it, you need to see through our eyes. You need to imagine a world where you're the minority, where you're the disadvantaged, when you put up with this crap daily, and I'm sick of it. And this with the history, and this with the mandatory sentencing, and this with the reduction of 10-year-old kids, I just said, you know what, no, I'm going to set an example here, and I'm actually going to step away from this prestigious job as chairman of the board, and I'm going to demonstrate where I belong, and that's with my people.
And that was part two of an interview I did with Dr. Richard Fijo from the Northern Territory, a Larrakia and Warramungu elder, and he was doing some serious truth telling. And we'll have one final part of that. Hopefully we'll be able to play that next week. And we'll go to a message and then we will have a bit of a chat. So look forward to that.
Listen back to Beyond the Bars 2024 Prison Broadcasts on the 3CR website, 3cr.org.au/Beyond the Bars 2024. Our all-black presenter team take you inside six Victorian prisons, Dame Phyllis Frost, Barwon, Fulham, Loddon, Marganeet and Port Phillip, to hear stories, songs, opinions and poems from Aboriginal inmates on NAIDOC Week 2024. Connecting the participants with culture and community and to keep the fire burning, black, loud and proud. Go to 3cr.org.au/beyond the bars for all the details.
Welcome back. 7:35 on 3CR.
8:55 AM. Or you could be listening on the community radio app. Or in the future, you could be podcasting us.
In the future, indeed.
And if you're listening in from the future, perhaps you'll be able to tell us what happened with Rising Tide Australia in Canberra, which is where their next stop is. I've just been having a look and seeing that there were over 7,000 people that attended Rising Tide up in Newcastle.
That is a big number.
It's a big number.
Yes.
And 170 of them were arrested, with 14 of those being under the age of 18.
I happened to see an excellent interview with one of the organisers on Sky News, where the journalist was really doing their hardest to try and make the organizer look as bad as possible, but the organizer was very organized and had all their facts and ducks in a row, and did an excellent job of refuting the pro-business and pro-coal and oil companies' propaganda and doing their job on behalf of them. So I'll try and find the details for that and put it in the show notes, because it's just fun to sometimes see see the those people challenged thoroughly. Mm. Yes,
but Marty, you had a question about Rising Tide.
Yes, and nothing to do with it possibly having something to do with today's rain and the water all around us. Is just if. A bit of background on Rising Tides and just exactly what it's all about.
So Rising Tide is, it's been going, I'm not even sure how long now, at least 3 or 4 years. There's been a blockade of the Newcastle coal port by people in kayaks and small boats of every description, trying to slow down the export of coal. And it makes a really, it's really visually striking.
It's a hugely innovative way to try and make a point, or to make a point, I should say.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't know if either of you saw, or if any of the listeners saw, there was some really stark imagery of this massive coal tanker, which they managed to delay leaving Newcastle. And these tiny, tiny little boats buzzing around it like flies. But they managed to slow it down and to, you know, just have that impact on it. But as you say, it's also about the imagery.
Yeah.
It's about making the point that the people of Newcastle, who in theory are supposed to be, you know, some of the key beneficiaries from the export of coal, there are people there who are protesting against it. That recognise that their own quality of life has been impacted by coal mining and things, and who want the government to put us on track for a safe climate future, which at the moment there doesn't seem to be much evidence of.
Yeah, and that was sort of one of the main points of the organisers, is that, you know, if we're not doing or putting in measures for the future, if we're looking at just relying on coal and we're just talking about coal and we're selling coal
and gas
and all this stuff, then it's like, okay, well, actually, you know, the organizers were making a point that the markets for those things are you know, reducing now. Mm. You know, China is one of the biggest, one of our biggest buyers, along with Korea, Japan. And actually they're, you know, especially in the case of China, they're buying less and less as they move towards renewables.
And we know that Japan, I mean, we've had a couple of interviews on the show about the decreasing demand for gas in Japan and how they're actually trying to use it to use Australian gas to dominate Southeast Asian markets rather than for their own supply, which makes, you know, no sense. We're exporting this stuff with hardly anything in the way of tax returns. Mm. We don't tax it. Australians pay more in hex debt than the oil and gas companies do in royalties, which is, but before we move on to a song or something, I just wanted to say one last statistic from The Rising Tide, which I thought was fantastic. 104 toilets were cleaned by the protesters every day.
The unsung heroes.
I thought that was great. And 20,000 plus meals were made, which is also and just to say, they will be going to Canberra next. Mm-hmm. So keep your eyes and ears peeled for updates on what Rising Tide are doing.
Very good. Great stuff. And yes, we will go to a song before we go to our next interview. It's 7:41 on 3CR, and this is Kutcher Edwards. That was Kutcher Edwards. Kutcher Edwards with Get Back Up Again from his excellent album from 2012, Black and Blue. And it's 7:44 now on 855 3CR.
So just 2 days ago, ProPublica, a US public independent news publication, published a story about a 35-year-old woman, Portia Ngumezi, I hope I've pronounced that correctly, who died, you could say was killed, because of the abortion laws in Texas. She'd had a miscarriage, and because doctors were reluctant to perform a D&C on her, she died in hospital after losing her pregnancy at 11 weeks. She was in emergency for more than 6 hours, and she bled so much that she needed 2 blood transfusions. She had 2 young sons, and was the 3rd woman in Texas to have died as a result of the changes to abortion laws in the states since the overturn.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
Learning of Roe v. Wade. To try and ensure that this sort of thing doesn't happen here, we've got Dr. Sarah Mansfield from the Victorian Greens on the phone to talk about a proposed constitutional amendment that they're putting through. Hi, Sarah. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Good morning.
Can you tell us what your proposed amendment is?
Yes. Yeah, so the Greens have put forward a bill that would enshrine access to abortion in the Victorian Constitution. What that would mean is that the laws that we have in this state that allow access to abortion would be protected from any future government that sought to change those laws. Changing the Constitution is a very high bar, so you need at least 60% of the Parliament to do that. And we believe this is a way of ensuring that, you know, people's personal politics and ideology don't get in the way of ensuring that people have access to what is basic healthcare.
Now, why are you putting this forward? I mean, obviously there's the Roe v. Wade overturning and Trump's election victory in the States, but why is this important here in Australia?
Yeah, so the case you mentioned earlier is obviously absolutely heartbreaking. I mean, that is so tragic, and it shows you what can happen when you let ideology, enter a space when it should be a matter of, you know, access to basic fundamental health care. It has created all of this awful complexity, and it's having tragic consequences. If we think we're immune from that sort of politics here in Australia, you'd be wrong. We're already seeing it. If you look at the recent Queensland election, abortion was brought up as an issue. They've only relatively recently decriminalised abortion in Queensland, and there was already discussion of changing some of those laws. In South Australia, very recently, there was an attempt to wind back access to abortion, and that was only narrowly defeated in that parliament. Federally, we're also hearing
Could we just stop a second and talk a bit about that South Australian one? When you say it was narrowly defeated, what sort of margin are we talking there? Do you know?
I don't have the numbers on off the top of my head.
I'm sorry, I do. There were 9 votes that were in favour of it was on late term abortions. There were 9 votes in favour of removing the right to late term abortions and 10 votes against. And
yes.
Those
so that's
9...
what you're talking about.
Pardon?
That's what we're talking about. It's that close. And, you know, while at the moment it's, you know, what we've heard, and it's heartening, you know, that the government, and we've heard from the opposition, they have no intention at the moment to change any, you know, of our abortion laws. But a change in government, a change in the makeup of parliament, which does happen, could mean that this issue is back on the table, and it doesn't take much to wind back that access that's been really hard fought. And you don't have to look very far back in history to see what things were like in Victoria when abortion was illegal. You know, it still happens, but in extremely unsafe, you know, conditions, and has often tragic consequences for the people involved.
Yeah, I think one of the slogans that they had before the US election was, you can't ban abortion, you can only ban safe abortion.
Absolutely, absolutely. And as I said, you don't have to look very far back in Victoria's history. You know, you go back a few decades and you see what that looks like.
Now, in the press release that you put a couple of weeks ago on this proposed amendment, you also mentioned that there's already a lot of harmful barriers when it comes to accessing abortion in Victoria. Could you talk a little bit about that?
So at the moment, although it's legal, trying to get an abortion can be very difficult for people. This is very, you know, it's very difficult in some rural and regional parts of Victoria where there are just no local abortion providers. There are different types of abortions you can access, medical and surgical, and there are some parts of Victoria where there is neither available. We also know that many people experience, you know, people who have different views about abortion then not providing, you know, effective referrals to places where they can access that service if they don't want to provide them themselves. So while I respect that people might have a personal conscientious objection, you do have an obligation under the law to refer people on. And we know that there are, you know, some of the different service providers have told us stories, people who have had situations where that hasn't been occurring. So they're just some of the barriers that exist, you know, not being able to access a provider or, you know, the service probably existing, but people who haven't, you know, their own views about it, stopping people from accessing information about it or accessing those services.
And in that regard, there was earlier this month, just over the border in New South Wales, Orange Health Service in central New South Wales have said that they can no longer provide abortions for patients with, quote, no identified pregnancy complications. So, and that was just after the Trump election, and I think that that was showing an impact here on the debate and the confidence that some people who are ideologically opposed to a woman having the right to medical care for her own body, the confidence that they felt in putting forward measures like that.
Yes, and I think, you know, again, this is where, you know, we have to protect any of the access we've got. We've got enough things we've got to work on. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't have to fight for this access again, you know, because people want to wind back, you know, the laws that we've already got. One of the issues is that, you know, I mentioned before that sometimes it's individuals who hold views. We know that there are some institutions that just don't provide the service, some publicly funded hospitals, sometimes religious, sometimes non-denominational, that for whatever reason don't provide abortion services. We believe that's wrong. You know, if you're a publicly funded service, this is a basic part of healthcare that should be provided. It's very difficult to get a full picture of where the problems are, though, because a lot of the data isn't collected. You know, this is something that's still, which I just find appalling. You know, again, with all parts of our healthcare system, we collect really good data, and it's like there is still a lot of stigma around abortion, and to the extent that governments are not collecting data and releasing it publicly on, you know, which services are providing, you know, terminations of pregnancy. So I think, you know, we still have a long way to go when it comes to improving access. We need to be working on that. It would be great to be focusing on that. I know that there are good people out there in the system, including government, who want to get some positive changes there. We don't need to then be fighting a battle about whether we should be allowed, you know, whether it should be allowed to be accessed at all.
Now, if we, if this constitutional amendment is to be passed, what needs to actually happen?
So, as I mentioned earlier, to change the constitution is a high bar. That's why it's a good thing to put this in the constitution. But it also means it's, you know, it's a tougher hurdle to get there.
Yeah.
We will need what's called a supermajority in the parliament. So that's at least 60% of both houses of parliament need to get behind this. We are quite optimistic, though. We're having positive discussions with the government. We look forward to some more discussions in the new year about how we can work together to get this done. Because I think, you know, as I said, there's people trying to do some good work to fix the problems we've got. They don't want to see that work undone by a future government. So it's in all of our interest to work together on this. And I would, you know, I would really welcome discussions with anyone on any side of the chamber on this issue. This is one where, you know, the parliament has to work together. This isn't about party politics, and I'm really optimistic we can get this done.
And what could listeners do to support this? I mean, obviously they should write to their local, to their state members of parliament for a start.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think that, you know, if you can let your state member of parliament know that this is something that's important to you, and why you want to see them get behind this change, that's incredibly important. They need to know that this is something that the people they represent care about.
And can I just ask one final question? What is it? What are the rights that would actually be protected if this constitutional amendment does go ahead?
So, Victoria has an Abortion Act that outlines, you know, that it's full of provisions that allow access to abortion. What this would do is put that act itself in the constitution. So everything that, you know, is legally already allowed in Victoria would be put in the constitution. There would be some wording in there as well that would ensure that, you know, you may want to change that act to improve access further in the future, and that would be fine. There'd be wording to ensure you could improve it, but you couldn't wind back the access that's already available.
Great. Is there any last thing that you'd like to tell our listeners about this?
Look, I think this is, you know, there are people that might say this isn't an issue in Victoria. We've done that. We've moved on. This is Australia. It's not America. I'd really encourage you to, you know, pause for a moment, look what's happened in other states and territories. You cannot assume that progress will just continue. These are hard-won rights. They can very easily be wound back, as we've seen elsewhere around the country and around the world. It's so important that we ensure that access to basic fundamental health care, which is what abortion is, you know, is protected for everyone who needs to access it and is put above politics.
Great. Thank you very much for your time this morning, Sarah. That was Sarah Mansfield, a member of the Victorian Greens in the State Parliament, talking about their proposal for a constitutional amendment to protect the right to safe abortion in Victoria.
And just so important, excuse me, to remember that these hard fought for rights are not, unless they're in the Constitution, then they could very much be removed again. And
as she says, it was an election issue up in Queensland where the Liberals won the election partly based on that platform. The vote in South Australia, which was nine votes in favour of restricting abortion rights, I mean, that was a cross-party group of people that included four women, and women from Labour as well as One Nation and the Liberals all coming together to try and restrict a woman's right to abortion. And then, as I say, even in New South Wales, with the hospital that's removing those services. So it's right on our doorstep. It's not like it's a million miles away.
It was one vote away.
It was one vote away in South Australia. Yep, exactly. Right. Shall we? We've got just received a request to read something. Marty, would
we
you?
We have, yes. This month it's a chance to help support local legal observers to build the capacity to defend civil and political rights across Victoria. Melbourne Activist Legal Support has been fielding legal observer teams at protests, monitoring and reporting on public order policing, providing human rights training and legal resources for protest movements for over 12 years. Melbourne Activist Legal Support are proudly independent, grassroots and all volunteer. You can help fund the front line, and your donation will train and equip more volunteer legal observers for more teams at more protests, provide Know Your Rights training to hundreds of new activists taking to the streets for the first time, support activists who are targeted because of their race, sex, sexual orientation, or political stance, hold more police to account for misconduct or excessive force, help push back against anti-protest laws, expanding police powers and weaponry. So you can donate via mals.au/donate. And you can do that any time this month when donations are welcome.
Are we going to a song?
I think
now?
We can. Yeah.
Does we've that got, sound like... Let's...
I think actually we've got this... I think St. Vincent might be in town tonight. And this is a track from St. Vincent. This is Hang On Me. St. Vincent, also known as Annie Clark, and Hang On Me.
Great music for a rainy day.
Yes.
Next up, we've got Natalie from Teachers for Palestine, who's going to be talking to us about scholasticide. Thank you very much for joining us this morning, Natalie. Are you there? Oh, wait one second.
Here she comes.
Here she is. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Sorry, we're just having technical hiccups. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, Natalie. Can you first of all perhaps tell us what scholasticide is?
Yeah, so scholasticide was a term created by Professor Karma Nabulsi. So she's a professor of politics and international relations at Oxford University. And the term is used to describe the systematic and systemic destruction of Palestinian education. And it's a term that's used to describe a specific mechanism of genocide. So it's the destruction of schools, universities, libraries, museums, archives, anything that represents knowledge, systems of knowledge. And it's also targeting people, including professors, teachers, students in Palestine. So anyone who represents either knowledge in terms of an intergenerational bearer of knowledge and also the future of knowledge, so students as well. And so at the moment, or as it stands, every single university building in Gaza was destroyed within the first 6 months of Israel's latest genocidal assault on Gaza. And as of September 2024, 90% of the schools in Gaza had been destroyed. So the destruction is intentional, and it's common knowledge that education is such an integral part of people's liberation, and that has been such a central part of Palestinian people's liberation. And so this is a threat to a genocidal entity like Israel. It's the same threat that is posed to any colonial occupation, in the same way that First Nations knowledge systems continue to be targeted in this settler colonial context as well. So, that's kind of a summary of what scholasticide is. It's a very brief one, but the term was created to describe this process of targeting the education system as intentional, with an objective in place to destruct the education system so that Palestinian people no longer have access to that knowledge.
And when you say that all the universities in Palestine have been destroyed, can you give us some idea of how many universities, what sort of destruction are we talking about?
Yeah, so I don't have an exact number, sure. But every single university building in Gaza was destroyed within the first 6 months.
And presumably that includes, libraries and as well as artefacts and a huge amount of cultural heritage that would have been in place at those universities.
Yeah, absolutely. And, archives are such an important part of a people being able to carry their stories, their histories along. And it's not the only way. And this is something that I really want to highlight as well, that Palestinian strength and endurance persist. And so whilst there is this destruction of Palestinian education, including things like their archives and their cultural heritage in that form, it continues in so many other ways, and that is a huge threat to a genocidal state that wants to destruct that in any way that it can. And we see that showing up in so many ways, even through this current onslaught, genocidal onslaught that Palestinian people are experiencing, that they continue to show that resistance.
Could you give us some examples of that?
Yeah, so we see teachers setting up classrooms in tents, and at refugee camps, we see that children are attempting to continue to learn how to read and write. They haven't been to school for over a year. And it feels like such a harrowing reality to think about. And we were so upset about that when COVID disrupted education in this context. And Palestinian children, young people, students have not gone to school for over a year, have not gone to university. But they continue to find ways to continue their education, and they do that with one another, and they take that responsibility on for each other. We also see young adults teaching children as well, and we also see people taking on a responsibility to make sure that people's social and emotional well-being is taken care of as well in the face of everything that's happening. So we see so many ways, and there's so many beautiful stories that are shared of professors that continue to try and disseminate the knowledge that they have, that try and take on that responsibility despite the circumstances that they face. So I think that that's something really important to highlight, but not to take away from the fact that the reason that they're in these circumstances is because of the targeted destruction of people, of the education system.
And I've just been looking up some statistics on this. So the Central Archives of Gaza, which contained, it says in this statement by the UN, 150 years of history, were destroyed. And this was before April this year, alongside, 95 university professors that had been killed by April, 5,479 students, 261 teachers, and the number of people injured was just devastating, needless to say. At the moment, we're in the middle of the 16 days of activism on gender-based violence. So I'd just like to ask, is there a gendered impact, do you think, in terms of particularly cultural knowledge that gets destroyed? Do you think that there's a disproportionate impact upon the types of knowledge that women hold?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we know that nearly 70% of deaths in Gaza are women and children, so they're a target of this genocidal onslaught. And what gets destroyed as part of that is devastating. We know that these figures represent so much in everyone's culture, and so when you target them, there's a very clear intentions behind why they're being targeted. And I think that such an important question to ask always, but especially, during 16 days of activism against gender-based violence, about what has allowed genocide and scholasticide to actually occur in the first place. And when we talk about primary prevention of violence, we know that it has to be about addressing the underlying and overarching structural and systemic issues that create and drive violence. And Imani Haidar, who wrote The Mother Wound, really highlights the link between state-sanctioned abuse with interpersonal abuse. And so we see that playing out within, you know, the what's happening with genocide and scholasticide in Palestine, that, that those dynamics are at play. And there's no way of not being able to see that. And so I think we really have to be willing to reckon with how this violence is produced and reproduced, who's targeted, why, and, yeah, what underlying kind of structural issues are causing this.
Now, there's a vigil tomorrow night. Could you tell us a bit about what's happening?
Yeah, so there's a vigil. It will begin at 6 p.m. and it's going to be held at Exhibition Fountain at Carlton Gardens. And the reason that we're holding the vigil for scholasticide in Palestine is to honour our fallen colleagues and students in Palestine, and to really try and bring scholasticide into the public's consciousness. I think that although the term has been around for quite some time, it is a term that we're still trying to familiarise ourselves with. And so we really want to make sure that, yeah, we bring that to the forefront so that people understand that this issue is occurring, to acknowledge and honour what has been lost, and to also acknowledge and honour the strength and endurance of Palestinian people, and their education as well. So anyone is welcome to join the vigil. It's open to the whole community. It starts at 6 p.m. You can come a little bit earlier. There'll be activities representing various parts of the education sector in Palestine. And then there'll also be a ceremony as well.
And who's supporting the vigil?
So there's various groups that have organised the vigil. So various people who represent their members from different education unions. So, for example, members from the National Tertiary Education Union, the Australian Education Union. And then there's various members from groups that are advocating for Palestine. So members from Teachers and School Staff for Palestine, NCU for Palestine. And so we've set up a campaign called Stop Scholasticide AU to try and hold those kinds of solidarities across the education sector as well. So there's a variety of different people that are leading this.
And if people can't get along to that, are there ways that they can either find out more or get involved?
Yeah, so you can head to the Stop Scholasticide AU .wordpress.com website, and that includes a lot of information about the Stop Scholasticide campaign, including an open statement that anyone affiliated with education can sign across the continent. And so that's something that we're really trying to build so that we can continue this work after the vigil, and also encourage other states and territories to, you know, do some of this work in their context as well. So South Australia is going to have a vigil as well on the same evening. So I think that, yeah, these kinds of solidarities are really important for us to continue to do this work.
And we'll put that link in our show notes today. There's also, you've asked, so the actions that I've got written down on Instagram were asking people to sign the scholasticide thing. We'll put the link there. Visit the website, promote the vigil, or hold a vigil in your own state. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Brilliant. Is there anything else that you'd like to say either about the vigil or about the issue overall?
I think I'd really just like to highlight that, you know, our education sector is deeply complicit in scholasticide. You know, we have partnerships with weapons companies. You know, we're arming Israel, and we're allowing this kind of violence to continue all across the world. And these are financial and non-financial arrangements that are in place, and this increased militarization across the education sector. So this Stop Scholasticide campaign is really trying to reckon with that, and trying to think about ways that, you know, how do we demilitarize education, and how do we stop the education sector from aiding and abetting genocide and scholasticide in Palestine and across various different contexts that are, you know, experiencing the violence of settler colonialism and imperialism as well. So yeah, I just really want to highlight that, you know, that I don't want to lose that focus as well, because that's really important to know that there's a sense of responsibility that people need to be held accountable to and systems need to be held accountable to in this as well.
Yeah, and I mean, the most recent one that we might have somebody on next week to talk about is the University of Sydney signing an agreement with the Hebrew University for exchanges with Israeli students there.
Yeah, and you know, these are various forms of complicity that the education sector does not want to face and does not want to be held accountable to, and so I think it's the members of the public, the members of the education sector that need to be doing this work every day to commit to the BDS movement and to mobilise within their context and to realise that.
Great. If there's nothing else that you'd like to add, then thank you very much for your time this morning, Natalie.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that was Natalie from Teachers for Palestine talking about the tomorrow night's vigil against scholasticide in Palestine.
That's another aspect of the ongoing conflict.
Yeah, and I thought it was really interesting the way that she tied that in with what's happened here with First Nations people, the erasure of language and culture and things that...
Past, present... and future.
Hopefully not future.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, hopefully not. Yeah.
And I know that the population in Palestine is one of the youngest populations in the world, with nearly a half of the whole country under 18, so children. So it's something that really needs to be highlighted, is the impact of the destruction of all of these educational materials through the universities and the libraries and museums, etc., along with, of course, the prevention of young people at getting access to education, being educated. And
indeed, the ability to study online, which we take for granted, using the internet, just the absolute destruction of all of those, that infrastructure, as well as the buildings.
I saw one young man who I believe was murdered shortly after, defending his thesis in a tent, which I thought was tragic and inspiring all at once. But yeah,
and obviously a purposeful attempt to because it does have such wide-ranging consequences when you target schools and universities and things. And
indeed.
Yeah.
Right. What are we going to next? Are we going to have a song or should we go to a community announcement?
We can have a tune if you like.
Let's have a tune.
Why not? This one, maybe a little celebration of some live music that was taking place over the past weekend, both on both sides of the river at Lulipalooza and also over south side in Balaclava, where they had the Balaclava Boogie. And this one is from local band The Miffs, who were part of Lulipalooza. Congratulations, everybody involved with those local festivals that brought lots of people together. And this is No Stairway from The Miffs. The Miffs with No Stairway at 8:23 on 3CR 855.
You could be listening to us on the community radio app. You could be listening to us in the future via podcast streaming, or you could be streaming live on www.3cr.org.au.
Yes, hello, future listeners.
I love that. I mean, it may be apparent, but I love the idea that we can time travel.
Yes.
If only in one direction.
I hope things are going well in the future.
Right, shall we have some community announcements?
Yes, absolutely. So tomorrow there is the End the Genocide, which is a genocide bill. It's Lydia Thorpe's bill, so there's going to be a protest. That's actually in Canberra at Parliament House. And it's an interesting one because Lydia Thorpe is basically proposing that the bill would propose that they remove the requirement for the Attorney General to consent to atrocity crime cases. This means that anyone would be able to file for proceedings on these crimes in court, and they would allow the cases that have been blocked by previous attorney generals since 2002 to be reviewed. So 2002 was when Australia signed onto this genocide convention. And just as a bit of background as well, so the Attorney General has unchecked power to block prosecution of genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity from proceeding in our courts here in Australia. And that's called, this is a special power called the AG's fiat. So Lydia Thorpe is introducing this bill, and there's a protest to go alongside that tomorrow in Canberra.
And if you are in Canberra after going to that, there's also the next wave of the Rising Tide blockade. So what will be happening there, she says as she tries to scroll down the huge number of events that are taking place for Rising Tide, is that they will be going to Parliament House, led by First Nations people, and setting up a two-day occupation of Parliament lawn for the final days of sitting for 2024. So that starts today, I think, and goes on for the next couple of days.
And I think those events will be live streamed as well on Zoom. Tomorrow night as well, back in Melbourne, there's the vigil for Scholasticide in Palestine. That's at Carlton Gardens at 6 p.m. On Friday, there is an event celebrating the life and legacy of Uncle Kevin Buzzacott. That's in Carlton North, beginning at 6 p.m. On Saturday, there's a mutual aid fundraiser for unwaged activists' fines. So that's happening at Nasty's Bar, 12 p.m. in Thornbury, 806 High Street.
Which is one of my favourite bars on that stretch. But hey, and then on the 5th of December, there will be a public meeting to defend the CFMEU called Why We Stand with the CFMEU. The speakers there will include Jade Ingham, the sacked national president of the CFMEU, Senator Fatima Payman, federal senator who resigned from the Labour Party over Palestine, and David Water, an industrial lawyer. So that's on the 5th of December, and you can, that will be at 6:30 at the Coburg Town Hall.
Before that, on Saturday also, there's a Collective Path to Liberation, First Nations and Global Perspectives on Resistance event. That's at 12 p.m. at Lupine Studio in Fitzroy North. After that, there's another fundraiser at Heidelberg Heights at El Siddiak Heidelberg Mosque. That's from 2 to 5. It's Gifts for Palestine fundraiser. And after that, there's on Saturday, it's a very busy Saturday, 3 to 5, there's the fortnightly Albert Out of Victoria Open Organising Meeting. So you can go along to that and help those organisers try and get Albert, the weapons manufacturing company, out of our state.
And perhaps one last one is there's the Degrowth Festival happening this Saturday as well. So that's, where is that going to be? I can't even.
That's an interesting one, Degrowth. Yes, the Degrowth Festival.
Yes, and I should know where it is because I'm going to have a stall there. So if you want to come on down.
While you're just checking that detail, I'll just do a quick reminder as well that this closing days of November, it's also a chance to make a donation, if you'd like, to Melbourne Activist Legal Support, which has been fielding legal observer teams at protests, monitoring and reporting on public order policing, providing human rights training, and legal resources for protest movements for over 12 years. And in November, if you'd like to donate, you can do so at mals.au/donate.
And I can't find the venue for the Degrowth Festival, but I'm sure if you're better at Googling than I am, you'd be able to get it. I could only get last year's one, and I know it's not at the same place this time. Radical Roots Community Garden, 12 Bell Street, Coburg. So that's where it is, happening this Saturday.
Amazing, Sonia.
Finally, two final things. Of course, Sundays we have the Free Palestine protests at the State Library from 12 p.m. And following that, 2:30 p.m., there's Camp Sovereignty smoking ceremony. So that's now a recurring event. And
Shall we do a really quick rundown, super speedy rundown?
We've
of
got
what
a
we
whole
today?
Minute to squeeze
we
in.
We had yes. Natalie from Teachers for Palestine talking about scholasticide. We had Sarah Mansfield from the Victorian Greens talking about a constitutional amendment to protect the right to abortion. And we had...
And we had an interview with Dr. Richard Feeger, Northern Territory Larrakia and Warramungu Elder from the Northern Territory.
And that's literally all we have time for today. Coming up next is Stick Together. Scholastics.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.